Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Elhamdülillahi rabbil alamin ve salatu vesselam ala seyyidil murselin ve ala alihi ve sahbihi ve sellem teslimen kesira. Rabbena lekel hamd kema yenbaghi li jalali vecik ve li azimi sultanik. Subhanaka la nuhsi thanaen aleyke ente kema athnayta ala nefsik. Allahumma salli ve sellim ve barik ala seyyidina Muhammed ve ala alihi ve sahbihi ve sellem teslimen kesira. Selamu aleyküm ve rahmetullah. Shalom, peace, welcome, good morning. So I'm honored to be here. It's a great honor, great pleasure to be in the presence of so many distinguished men and women, and to be in the presence of people who have really dedicated their lives to helping others. And it's a very noble calling, and it's always an honor to be in the presence, especially these days and times when it appears, at least superficially, looking at things, that there are less and less people inclined to dedicate their lives in the service of others in the way that all of you have. So it's a great honor to be in your presence and to address you. What I was asked to talk about was the issue of spirituality and its role in rehabilitation. And that's something that in the course of my work I have to deal with, because my work focuses on spirituality, on teaching religion, and it focuses on rehabilitation, not specifically the rehabilitation of incarcerated individuals, but the rehabilitation of individuals who are suffering from many of the same maladies that I think, if we really break things down to their essentials, play a very large role in leading to the incarceration of many of the individuals that you might work more directly with during the course of your daily professional activity. So there is a common bond between us, and that being the case, hopefully what I have to say will be relevant to you and not something that's foreign or inaccessible. First of all, I think is very important for us to acknowledge, and I think all of us do, no matter what our respective faith traditions might be, that the human being is multifaceted. At the very least, I think we can all accept as being valid the statement that the human being essentially is a physical creature, an intellectual creature, and a spiritual creature. That these three essential aspects combine within us to make us a very unique creature and to define us as being uniquely human. The spiritual and intellectual aspects, I would argue, these are the most important aspects of our creation as human beings. And I think those of you who are coming from the Christian or Jewish or Buddhist, at least, and probably most other faith traditions, would agree. Because the physical we share with others, and as a physical being, we're not particularly impressive. I mean, a lot of us look really good. A lot of you, as I look out on, I mean, you are impressive in that sense. But really, if you think about it, as a physical being, we're not terribly impressive. I mean, compared to the fish, our ability to remain underwater is extremely unimpressive. Compared to an orangutan, our physical strength doesn't measure. An orangutan is 9 times stronger than a human being. And so that's another sort of man. The Malay, orang is man. So orangutan, the jungle man. Or tang is man, and orang, jungle. So the jungle man is the orangutan. And he's 9 times stronger than a human being. So I would not recommend that you wrestle an orangutan, because you're going to lose. It's that simple. We just physically can't match up. So, orang gila. So, orang is man, tang is jungle. Orangutang is jungle man. Orang gila is a crazy man. And that's the extent of my Malay. Except, but ask me, how did you learn that? I mean, how do we get to crazy man? I was asking them, how would you describe certain individuals? I won't give any names because this is a nonpartisan gathering. So the spiritual is what distinguishes us. The intellectual is what distinguishes us. Because physically, as I said, we're not impressive. We can't swim like fish. Certainly we can't stay underwater like a fish. We can't wrestle with an orangutan. We can't fly like a bird. There have been people that have tried, and they met an untimely demise. You know, they put the wings on and jumped off cliffs, and they might have flapped a few times before they bottomed out. So those efforts weren't impressive. We can, but the intellectual, we're able intellectually to make a submarine. And nuclear-powered submarines stay underwater 6 months at a time. We're able to make an airplane and fly higher than any bird. We're able to even transcend the various levels of the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere. So this is what distinguishes us. There was a conversation I heard about. An individual was driving down the highway, listening to a talk show on his radio, and the discussion was about evolution. And the discussant was making an argument that the human being is unique. So the individual called in and said, "No, we're not unique. We're just like the other animals. We're just an animal, essentially, and that's all we are." And so the person that was discussing the issue, he responded and he said, "Okay, you know, if you want to believe that there's no difference between you and I and a monkey, you can believe that." But he said, "I never saw a monkey driving down the highway 70 miles an hour, talking to someone 1,000 miles away on a cell phone that's bouncing a beam off a satellite in outer space. I just never saw that. But if you want to believe, I never saw a monkey do that. If you want to believe you're just like a monkey, that's your right. You know, it's America, we're free." So our unique intellectual capacity has given us the capability to fly higher than the birds, to stay in the water in some instances longer than some species of fish, possibly, to communicate in ways that would only be deemed as magical. If someone who lived even 50 years ago could come back today and witness, this computer has a wireless card in it, so I could actually send a message or a picture and to you on your cell phone, and if you had the proper hookup with the printer, you could print that picture, and I'm just pushing buttons, and you're just pushing buttons, and all this is happening, no physical wires connecting us in any sort of way. So it would only be described as magic. It can only be described as magic. Just poof, images are popping up, we push a button, and I'm watching a live stream of someone halfway around the world giving a speech. And that's magic for a lot of people. But that's what our minds have been able to unlock. So that's one of the things that I would argue, and I'm sure a lot of you would agree, maybe not all, that makes us distinctly and uniquely human, as opposed to the rest of the animal kingdom. However, I would argue the thing that really distinguishes us as human beings is our spiritual potential. Our potential to long for, to yearn for, to understand the divine. This aspect of our creation, I would argue, is what really and truly distinguishes us, because the capacity that we have in this regard, we could argue, some people would argue a dolphin is more intelligent than a human being. There are people that argue like that. The IQ of the dolphin, and I believe it definitely, I've seen some smart dolphins and some challenged people. But they say, but the dolphin just doesn't have hands with the thumb and the proper appendage to be able to make tools and subsequently to develop the things we've developed. So any dolphin lovers out there, you can chalk up one for Flipper. I don't know if the dolphin did have a hand, if he could do that, but there are people that argue. Intellectual, dolphin is very, you look at the dolphin's frontal lobe and you know there's something going on up there. But our capacity to yearn for the divine, our capacity to know the divine, and our capacity to try to conform our lives to the dictates of the divine, I think it would be very, very difficult to argue that any creature in the animal kingdom shares that. So I would argue this is the most distinguishing aspect of our humanity. And our reaching our full human potential is intricately connected with our ability to cultivate and to develop that capacity. So as a Muslim, this aspect of our nature and our literature sometimes is referred to as the qalb, as the heart. Not the physical heart. The physical heart is viewed as being the locus of this capacity. Sometimes it's referred to as the ruh. So the qalb, God says in the Quran, أَفَلَا يَتَدَبَّرُونَ الْقُرْآنَ أَمْ عَلَى قُلُوبٍ أَقْفَالُهَا. Do they not reflect and ponder on the message of the Quran, or are their hearts sealed? In other words, not their physical heart, because if that were sealed up, then their bodies would cease to be able to live. But is this capacity to know, to understand, and to yearn for the divine that's unlocked through the signs that are related to us in the scripture and the signs that we see in the natural world, is that capacity sealed up and blocked off and unable to perform its proper function? It's sometimes referred to as the ruh. So again, in the Quran, we read, ثُمَّ سَوَّاهُ وَنَفَخَ فِيهِ مَا الرُّوحِ. Then he made the human being upright. And our uprightness is something very unique. There are animals that can temporarily stand upright. But even the apes, most of them are angled. So you see a gorilla is angled. Chimpanzees, when they walk, they're at an angle. So most animals, or virtually all animals except the human being, for that reason, and this is something unique to us, when they are walking and approaching each other, eventually their hearts, which are in their breast, is pointing towards the ground. So for example, a dog that's walking on all fours, his chest is parallel to the ground. His heart is pointing down. The gorilla that's maybe at a 45-degree angle, eventually his heart is pointing towards the ground. But because we're upright, when we face and come together, our hearts are facing each other. Our hearts are projecting the spiritual energy outwards towards each other. So for one aspect of our teaching, we're told as Muslims, وَلَا تَدَابَرُوا. Don't turn your backs to each other. So in other words, don't break off social relations. Because by so doing, you're not only breaking off social relations, but you're turning your spiritual, positive spiritual energy away from each other when you turn your backs to each other. And when you face each other and you come together, you're bringing your hearts together. So this is a unique aspect. Sawahu, we've made the human being upright. And then وَنَفَخَ فِيهِ مُرْرُوحِ, and then God has breathed into him something of his spirit. Not, we don't believe the spirit of God, but this subtle quality that God has created, and he's, we say, attributed to himself to honor and ennoble that aspect of our creation. So we say Baytullah, Ruhullah, we say this is idafat al-tashrif. This is an appendaging of honoring and ennobling. So he's ennobled him with this spirit and this life spirit that sustains the life and that is able to articulate these various qualities. Sometimes it's referred to as the nafs. Ya ayyatuha nafsul mutma'inna. Oh, you contented soul. So again, a level of spiritual development where the human being has come through various stages from the nafs ammara bisu. So the soul that inclines towards wickedness because it is overwhelmed by the physicality in the human creation. Nafsul lawama, the soul that begins to reproach itself, to try to rebuke itself for wrong, to encourage itself to do good. And then the soul that struggled through that stage and is inclined towards good. Nafsul mutma'inna, mardiyya, radiyya, pleased, pleasing to God. So these aspects of our composition, we believe that this is our most distinctive humanizing feature. Now, how does this relate to our situation in the context of dealing with incarcerated individuals or dealing with individuals in society in general that are experiencing various types of problems? We would say that there are many things in our environment today that prevent us from being whole, that prevent us from cultivating the spiritual aspect of our creation, and increasingly that prevent us in a healthy way from cultivating the intellectual aspect of our creation. We say sometimes what's happening to our students, the SAT test scores are down, the ACT scores are down, scholastic achievement tests are down, way down from 30 years ago. Well, one thing, we no longer teach our students how to think. Now the emphasis is on teaching them how to take tests. You have no child left behind. As one critic said, no child's behind left. We no longer teach our children how to think. I see one of our Catholic sisters here. They're probably one of the last groups left that take the foundation of education seriously. The trivium, quadrivium, the fundamentals. Grammar school, we used to actually teach grammar along with logic and rhetoric. So that's the trivium. And then the quadrivium with that base established to move on to geometry and music, application of time and bringing together time and space and astronomy, understanding the cosmos. So how can we have a healthy cosmology if we don't even think about the cosmos? So that was a fundamental part of our educational system. Astrology and arithmetic. So the fundamentals in terms of how to think, so the basis of that, rhetoric, grammar, logic, grammar school, how to think. And so all of that was discarded. And increasingly we teach children what to think. And lately, not even what to think, but how to take a test. And then we say, you know, why are they failing the test? Why are the scores down? So we're not whole, generally speaking. And increasingly, more and more members of our society, so not we here in this room, but generalizing. And increasingly, more and more members of our society are not whole. And a lot of that, as we said, is due to conscious neglect in terms of teaching spirituality in whatever capacity, in terms of teaching how to think and how to develop our intellectual capacities, but also the tremendous disproportionate emphasis that's placed on the physical aspects of our composition. So impulsiveness generally is rooted in our physical appetites. And think of just the messages. I'll just try to think of some that come to the top of my head. We have the soda advertisement, "Obey your thirst." Right, so a physical appetite. So don't obey your creator. Don't obey God. However you define God, obey your thirst. Obey your physical impulses. And at one time, obeying your thirst meant a nice cold glass of water. Muslim brothers and sisters, I'm not going to drink it. Astaghfirullah. Ramadan, that's like, I always say, astaghfirullah. I seek Allah's forgiveness for that brother. He's up there getting ready to drink some water. No, I'm just making a point. At one time, there was nothing better to obey your thirst in terms of satisfying it than an ice cold glass of water. Now you have to obey your thirst by drinking Coke or Pepsi so they can make some money on our impulsive submission to our physical carnal appetites. Aren't you hungry for Burger King now? You know, suggestion again, you know, aren't you ready to satiate one of your carnal appetites? And again, the only way you can do that is by pulling into Burger King. Don't pull into the rival spot. Or we will have to do another study to determine how we can get you to ours. So again, but the message is a subtle message urging us to be impulsive. Impulsive in our obedience to our carnal appetite. Now, and so that's food and drink. Obey your thirst. Aren't you hungry for Burger King now? When we move into the realm of our sexual appetite and all the messages that are there that are constantly telling us to obey and to submit to that appetite, we'll be up here the rest. How long is this conference? We could dedicate the rest of the conference to that. We get that in the billboards, the magazines, the television, the internet, the print media, you name it. We're bombarded with that message. And unfortunately, so are our children. And again, we wonder what we tell our little boys in some neighborhoods through music that they're hearing, and not due to their parents' choice, public airwaves, telling this little boy, "You're a player, you're 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 a gangster, you're a gangster, you're a gangster, you're a gangster." So what's that kid going to grow up and try to become? Telling the little girls, "You're a hoe, you're a hoe, you're a hoe, you're a hoe." And so she hears that as soon as she's cognitively able to process it. And when she's 13 or 14 and she's had one baby and two abortions, what do we expect? if those are the messages that are in very sophisticated ways, we're not talking about some overt, blunt message. We're in very sophisticated ways being planted into the minds and into the hearts of our children, because we talked about this capacity, this qalb, ruh, nafs. It can be cultivated for the good and lead us to yearn for the divine, or it can be cultivated in a negative manner, because a heart can be pure and a heart can be corrupted. A soul can be pure and a soul can be corrupted. And again, in the Quran, as Muslims, we read that very fact, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا وَقَدْ خَابَ مَنْ دَسَّاهَا. He or she is successful who cultivates this property in a healthy way, and he or she is ruined who cultivates it in a negative way. So there are a lot of messages that are encouraging our children from the youngest ages to cultivate these properties in a negative fashion. And as a result of that, they end up obeying their thirst and drinking alcohol at 12 or 13 years old and losing interest in school and obeying their desire for sexual relations and then getting caught in all of the psychological trauma that accrues to an undeveloped individual, individual becoming intimately involved with another human being at that level. Most of the teen suicides, what are they associated with? Either relationships that have gone bad. So our daughter comes home, my friend cut her wrist yesterday. Why? Because Bobby left her. Or because of their inability to fit comfortably into that whole scene of premature sexuality. So the nerd who can't fit in is ostracized and can't get the girls or can't get attention from the guys. And as one of the popular singers said many years ago, I learned the truth at 17 that love was meant for beauty queens. And then so this one who's not the beauty queen and doesn't get the attention, the self-esteem goes down, and then the behavior starts to deteriorate, and then she or he, if it's a guy, ends up because of the low self-esteem or be engaging in reckless behavior that leads them to a correctional institution. So the physical, the stimuli that's bombarding the physical senses creates a distorted human being. So the neglect of the spiritual and the intellectual, accompanied with the extreme overemphasis on the physical, creates a distorted human being. And it is distorted human beings who end up with behavioral problems. It is distorted human beings who end up with low self-esteem, or who end up so filled with pride, arrogance, and hubris that there's no thought given to transgressing and usurping the rights, the feelings, the consideration of others. This is a distortion in the human character. Now, when we talk about addressing the consequences of that distortion, addressing the criminality that it oftentimes leads to, addressing the behavioral problems that manifest themselves in criminality that it sometimes leads to, this, I believe, is a fundamental basis, has to be a fundamental basis of rehabilitation, of making that person whole, of making that person whole, and by being whole, able to exist comfortably in a society with other human beings. So what do, and I'm speaking from an Islamic perspective. You can make the same case from a Christian, a Jewish, a Buddhist perspective. I'm not familiar with Hindu theology, but I'm sure You could do the same thing from a Hindu perspective, but I'm speaking from the perspective that I've been trained in. But I'm sure you can all relate to it. Now, how do we make this human being whole again? I would say that is the essence of the spiritual challenge. How do we build up that spiritual aspect of the human being? And how do we check the overemphasis on the physical aspect of the human being? I'll make a couple suggestions. One is going back to a fundamental teaching of at least the Abrahamic religions, and that is that the human being is created in the image of God. Now, some Muslims might start shuddering at this point. What are you trying to say? Laysa kamithlihi shay. There's nothing like God. How could we be created in the image of God? From our perspective, as a reflection of the names and attributes of God. So we say as Muslims, we know God through his names and attributes. Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, Al-Malik, Al-Quddus, Al-Salam. So the merciful, the compassionate, the sovereign, the holy, the As-Salam, the one free from any defectiveness. So through the names and attributes we know God. So through building up the human person so that the human being comes to reflect those names and attributes to the extent humanly possible. This is, for us, one of the greatest keys to bestowing onto a human being his or her spiritual balance, or providing a basis for that person coming, gaining spiritual equilibrium. So, as we mentioned, to understand, as a human being, you will only be human if you are merciful. As a human being, you will only be human if you are, in a spiritual sense, if you are compassionate. You will only be human if you're al-alim, if you're knowledgeable. So you have to develop yourself intellectually, and that will enhance your spiritual development and your wholeness as a human being. You will only be human if you're shakur, if you're appreciative. You will only be human if you're sabur, if you're patient and forbearing. And this is one of the great names and qualities of God. What if God didn't forbear with our transgressions? What if God wasn't patient in dealing with us? First mistake, bam, zip, lightning bolt, storm clouds gather. Aha, I saw you take a peek at that. Channel surfing. No, you weren't channel surfing. You were on an active hunt. And you found what you were hunting for. That's it. One slip, that's it. It's all over. No, God forbears. God is patient. God gives us time to repent. God gives us time to amend our ways. God gives us time to think about it, to reflect, and to return back to the path of right guidance. So being forbearing in our dealings with others, being clement, halim. So this is one of the, we believe, surest paths to the restoration of spiritual balance within a human being. And this is one of the surest bases for bestowing self-esteem on a human being, because now I don't measure myself based on my relationship or based on how I see other human beings. And therefore, when I see myself falling short, there's room for jealousy. When I see myself not measuring up, there's a, there's room for the lessening of my self-esteem. I measure myself based on my relationship with God. And I know in that relationship, I will never measure up. But I can constantly try to do better. I can constantly try to do better. So I'll never be the epitome of mercy, but I can constantly strive to be better. I will never have unqualified knowledge. So we say God's knowledge is unqualified. It has no beginning. Everything we know has a beginning. It's not acquired. Most of the knowledge that we have was acquired. It's not qualified. The knowledge we have is qualified. So I'll never have absolute knowledge, but I can constantly strive to be more knowledgeable. And in that relationship, there's no room for jealousy. There's no room for a lessened self-esteem, because it's not about me compared with another fragile, frail, weak human being. It's about me and my relationship with God. Secondly, and in that sense, other religions, perhaps from a different angle, I think, share that point of view, that we are created in the image of God, and this provides a starting point for our journey towards human perfection. Secondly, adorning ourselves with prophetic character. So in this regard, choose your prophet. So you could, if you're Jewish, you might prefer Moses. If you're Christian, you might prefer Jesus. If you're Buddhist, you might prefer the Buddha. As Muslims, we believe that we can learn from all of them, but our primary example is the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and peace be upon all the prophets and messengers of God. So trying to adorn ourselves with prophetic characteristic and simultaneously trying to rid ourselves of lowly, vile characteristics that are usually epitomized by what in the Abrahamic tradition is referred to as Satan. So Satan epitomized jealousy, envied Adam. Why should Adam have this great honor? I'll show God he's undeserving. I'll waylay him, lead him astray. Or we say racism. So is a satanic quality. So why? Because in our teaching, when Satan is asked, why did you not prostrate yourself to God when you command, well, to Adam, when I commanded you to do so? مَا مَنَعَكَ أَلَّا تَسْجُدَ إِذْ أَمَرْتُكَ قَالْ, he said, أَنَا خَيْرٌ مِنَ, I'm better than him. Why? خَلَقْتَنِي مِنْ نَارٍ وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِنْ طِينٍ, you made him from me from fire, and you made him from clay. I'm not going to prostrate myself to mud man. No way, I'm better. So I'm better based on my physical composition. So we see every racist following in those satanic footsteps. I'm better because of my physical color. You made me white, and you made him black. You made me black, and you made him brown. You made me brown so I could go both ways, and you made him white and her black. So my physical, my eye color, my hair texture, this is a satanic way of thinking. So we see that as embodying the negative traits that we have to rid ourselves of, and adorning ourselves with the prophetic traits of virtue, of courage, of sharing, charity rather, ridding ourselves of sloth, which was one of the great sins, to be slovenly, which isn't laziness, and that's laziness is laziness. To be slothful was to be lazy in one's spiritual pursuit. Because one of the missions of the human being, as we mentioned, is to enter on this spiritual journey, to know God, to move towards God. And so a person who wasn't motivated to do that was deemed as being spiritually lazy. And therefore, as being a human being, that was not to be envied. Someone who was to be pitied. So the prophet showed what spiritual striving and yearning was all about. To have that capacity to reach for God and to strive for God. We mentioned obey your thirst. The person on the spiritual quest is trying to obey his or her God, his or her creator, and therefore to deny their thirst. So don't drink everything that you might long for, because some of it might be harmful. Overindulgence in any of it, no matter how good it is not a healthy thing. Discipline yourself. Delay gratification. I was recently made aware of a study, and again, if we're talking about rehabilitation, sometimes that starts at a very early age in terms of checking the development of qualities that might lead to behaviors that are unacceptable or to believe to certain orientations that aren't healthy. There was a study done where 5-year-olds were offered one cookie right now or 2 cookies in 10 minutes. And then the two groups, their lives were followed until they were, I believe, 20 years old. And all of the kids that delayed gratification had more productive and healthy lives. All the kids that said, oh, I could get 2 cookies later, I'll wait. They generally had more productive lives than the kids that give me my cookie right now. And again, in terms of changing the environment that's leading a lot of our children to fail, how much of the messages they're bombarded with are urging them to indulge in instant gratification? So if we're serious about changing that, the president, after the recent spate of violence in the schools, the Amish situation, and the same week the principal getting shot in Wisconsin, and then the situation in Colorado. California has its own issues. Don't dump Colorado's issues on California. But within a week, we had these three incidents, terrible situations. So the president says, you know, we have to convene a conference on school violence. We don't need a conference. And if we do have a conference, if we're not going to talk about addressing some of the fundamental issues that are encouraging instant gratification, that are encouraging the commodification of our children, that are encouraging these messages, that are encouraging them to think of themselves as prostitutes and to think of themselves as pimps and to think of themselves as dope dealers and hustlers, then we're wasting our time. And if we're not talking about, I hope none of you are in the NRA, but getting guns off the street, then we're wasting our time. You know, we can have a conference upon conference upon conference, but if we're not actually making policy prescriptions to deal with some of the underlying issues, I mean, our kids have been getting angry for a long time. The phenomenon of the angry child is nothing new. And kids have been fighting each other. When most of us were growing up, we had our own version of the Bloods and the Crips. It wasn't that deep, maybe. Not making anything up, Imam Antar. But we couldn't get our hands on guns. So if you couldn't do it with your bare hands or with some rocks, if you couldn't get the job done like that, well, You're out. You're just caught out. But we couldn't get our hands on guns. Our communities weren't flooded with guns. AK-47s, MAC-10s, AR-15s, you name it. Just come, look in the trunk. What do you want? And those kids that are using the guns and as a result filling up the prisons, they don't make the guns. And we can't argue, oh, well, it's just so hard to keep the guns out of the community. During the Bosnian War in the early 90s, we kept guns out of the whole country of Bosnia. We had an arms embargo on the Bosnians. And they couldn't get any guns. So if we can keep the guns out of Bosnia, we can keep the guns out of Watts and Oakland and who knows where else. But there has to be a conscious effort. And if we're not willing to address some of the policies that facilitate the behavior, that facilitate the foundation, that supports the situation that leads to incarceration, then we're not being serious in our efforts to rehabilitate. We have to take a holistic approach. And this aspect, spirituality, not to get too far off on a tangent, is an essential part of that approach. So seeing and cultivating in the human being the idea that you are a reflection of God to the extent humanly possible, and that you potentially are a bearer of prophetic character, and therefore you are a special creature. You are a special and unique creation, and you are higher. There's a book, actually, I actually have it with me, that discusses this whole idea of taking on, reflecting rather, the names and attributes of God by one of the great Muslim scholars, Al-Izz bin Abd al-Salam, a Syrian-Egyptian scholar who lived about 800 years ago. And in any case, he says in terms of one of the names of God is Al-Mutakabbir. So the one who is arrogant and haughty, which is fitting God's majesty. So he says, at first glance, a person might think it's not appropriate for a human being to reflect this particular name of God. Then he says, however, there is an appropriate human reflection of this name, Al-Mutakabbir. And he said, that lies in the human being seeing himself above and being too good to engage in certain vile and petty behavior. So, and people are getting killed. Some of you might have seen 3 days ago, a study released that violence in our society, especially youth violence, is becoming epidemic. And they mentioned, by way of example, an incident over a petty little argument that took place in Trenton, New Jersey. 7 people ended up getting shot. 7 young people were shot. That this one called that one a name, and they got offended, so they shot their friend. Their friend was in this gang, and the gang retaliated and shot them, and then they shot, and it went back and forth over a little petty insult that led to 7 shootings. So Mutakabbir, they said that your teeth are so yellow, they thought they were little grains of corn. What? Well, tell them that their mother so skinny she could hula hoop with a Cheerio. You're talking, just cut it off at the beginning. They said that, you know what, I'm not even going there. I don't have time to retaliate to something. Tell them I'll pray for them. Tell them I'll pray for them. That's Mutakabbir in a human being above vileness and pettiness. And a lot of these young men and women that are in these prisons, it started by something totally petty.
And you hear it every day. You know, how'd you end up here? You know, I'm embarrassed to even tell you. And it, you say, wow. So that's mutakabbir, to be above being pulled down to such petty and vile levels that might lead to consequences that we'll thoroughly regret in the future. So we'll stop here, and I don't know how it's organized, but if there's any room or time for any questions or discussion, preferably discussion, we'll do that. Thank you for your patience and indulgence. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ماذا أقول في وصفه ومديحه.
Zaytuna Institute Knowledge Resources are a means of connecting you to the sacred knowledge being taught and preserved at Zaytuna Institute. Utilizing the latest multimedia distribution formats, these resources serve as a means to facilitate the study, comprehension, and practice of the traditional sciences of Islam for students and seekers around the world. For more information on traditional Islam in America, please contact Zaytuna Institute at 510-582-1979 and on the internet at www.zaytuna.org, zaytuna.org.